This is the PubRight Podcast, a service of the Arbortex community.
So, welcome to the PubRight Podcast. This morning I have Bob Thomas from Tag Smiths. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Hi, Liz. How are you doing?
I'm good. Do you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm Bob Thomas. I'm the owner and whatever of Tag Smiths, and I have a long career as a technical writer. In the mid-90s, I became involved with a project at Lucent where we decided to migrate from an old frame maker shop to doing an SGML migration. So,
back in the mid-90s,
I did a career change in 95 and went to a number of DTD design sessions / dogfight sessions. And, Lucent, we ended up modeling the information mapping method.
Okay.
Modeling the semantics of that. So, yeah,
do you want to talk a little bit about this? Because a lot of the listeners are brand new to even thinking about doing dynamic publishing.
Yeah, basically, information mapping is has this notion of information types, just like DITA does. It actually preceded DITA by a few decades. I think during the 1960s, a guy named Robert Horn came up with this concept and marketed it. And basically, the idea is that you write about the purpose of the information for your users. So there is this notion of information types, like concepts and procedures and process and so on, and reference.
Right.
So,
very DITA-like.
Yeah, well, the DITA framework, they freely acknowledge that that is one of the inspirations for the whole concept of information typing. There are definite differences between information mapping and DITA, but it's pretty much the same theory or foundation behind the two.
Right. Fascinating. So you were doing that in the 90s at Lucent. How did that project go? Did you go with it?
Well, it went fairly slow. It was awfully expensive. And, that was just generally the nature of SGML publishing systems. Basically, you really didn't have a framework to start from. Everything had to be done from the ground up.
Right.
And, during that time, XML emerged as a standard, too. I think it was actually announced the same year we started.
Oh.
So, anyway, we stuck with SGML. We had all sorts of things going on with that. But, the really exciting thing about DITA is that so much of this heavy lifting that we ended up doing at Lucent has already been done through DITA Open Toolkit.
So do you want to talk a little bit about those kinds of things? Because that's where I wanted to go next.
Oh, sure. I think the neat thing about DITA, just even before I talk about the Open Toolkit, DITA was designed from the ground up to be customizable and extensible. And it's very easy through the DITA specialization mechanism to introduce your own information types and semantic vocabularies into the DITA framework. I guess what that means in plain language is that if you've identified an information type that you really want to have the semantics of that information type put in front of your writers, the DITA platform presents a very easy way to go ahead and implement that. And more importantly, you don't have to do a lot of custom style sheet work around that because there's this notion of inheritance. Like when you specialize something, there's lots of intelligent default behavior for your specializations. So you don't have to start from the ground up telling it how to do PDF or HTML every time you add a specialization. Those things are certainly possible if you need special formatting, but it gives you reasonable formatting.
So much of that seems to be just the nature of the way Ditto is designed and less tool specific.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's that's inherent in the information architecture behind Ditto.
So when you were back at Lucent, before we finish, mm-hmm. What drove them to make the transition? Did you know any of that?
Well, the primary, really the core of the business case was localization and savings on localization.
Right.
There was there were a number of other business reasons for doing it too. And that is, there was just a really large technical writing effort going on at Lucent. There were several hundred writers on staff, a wide array of products that were being documented. And one of the problems that we had at Lucent was that it looked like documents for different products were coming from different companies.
There
were arbitrary differences in design and that sort of thing.
Right. How many writers were there?
Oh, gosh, probably 200 or 300.
Fascinating.
And, a lot of those, most of them were quite talented, too. But, the problem is when you get that many talented people, getting them to do the same thing at the same time becomes difficult. I mean, if one out of every 10 of them perceives themselves as being an expert or a high-performing expert, then all of a sudden you've got 20 or 30 of these people running around thinking they know the best way to do everything.
Right, right.
So, that was one of the goals, was to come up with a mechanism to have a common look and feel and to try and, eliminate a lot of differences that didn't need to be there.
Right. And how many languages were you going to at the time?
Oh, gosh, it was at least 10.
Wow.
Some Asian languages, mostly European.
Fascinating. So, and then, so you went from there to a bunch of other projects. Where'd you go next?
After that, I took an early retirement from Lucent in 2001. They offered to start paying me a full pension if I went away, so I said goodbye.
Nice. That's a pretty long project, though, too. That's at least 10 years in the making at that point.
Well, no, it was 5 years.
Five.
Okay. So, anyway, I ended up getting a job working for a Boeing subsidiary, Jeppesen Sanderson, down in Englewood.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I worked with them doing conversion programming and OmniMark.
Oh, boy.
That was a skill I acquired on the Lucent project. I ended up taking over the maintenance of some code there and learned OmniMark in the process.
So what's your feeling about that product? How does that fit in? Where would people be using that today?
OmniMark? It's a proprietary conversion language. I went through the pain of learning it, so I'm highly partial to it. It's kind of like the VI editor. I went through a lot of pain to learn that in the 80s, and now I use it. I certainly wouldn't wish the VI editor on anyone, but once you learn it, it's great. I don't know. My feeling about OmniMark is that if you're doing high-volume conversion work, it's probably worth getting proficient at it. It's a very efficient way of converting things.
Excellent. That's great. And so, that's a lot of data. How much data conversion did you do at Lucent? How long did the products last?
Well, at Jeppesen's, where I was doing the conversion, we were doing conversion from aircraft maintenance manuals from various manufacturers, mainly Boeing and
right.
I think some Airbus stuff as well. And we were converting that into the Rainbow DTD for Dynatext. So that was that was very much a 90s technology, though. And the product went away after a couple of years. And then I moved on to another project at Jeppesen where we decided to go ahead and model the Jeppesen Airway Manual in XML using DocBook.
Interesting. What year was that?
That was 2002 or 2003 when we began that.
Sure. Makes a lot of sense then.
So that involved doing that and also getting a content management system. We ended up buying Astoria.
Okay.
And did some customizations on that as well.
Right.
We had a kind of a joint development project with Astoria Professional Services where we implemented a workflow client using the Eclipse platform. Actually, that client was the forerunner of the Astoria Workbench that they sell now.
Oh, how about that? There you go. Because I know that I don't want to go that way. Sorry, Roger. I lost my train of question with that. So Astoria was one of the... You saw that a lot with ArborText, actually, back at that point in time, mm-hmm. I remember. But there was never an adapter between the two. Did you guys have to do a lot of work integrating?
What, an adapter for ArborText?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they've had a bridge for ArborText for a long time.
Does Astoria maintain that then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's, I think that and XMetal are the two that they've had for a while. Also FrameMaker, too, I believe.
Right.
The structured frame adapter, too. So I think those are the three bridges that they support right now.
For Astoria, yeah.
Yeah, they also offer some functionality through WebDAV as well, I believe.
I think so.
So, for example, you can do some things through Oxygen using WebDAV and Astoria.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's cool. So, and then I ran across your name first at Avaya when I did some data conversion for them.
Well, yeah, Avaya is a Lucent spinoff, and in fact, they spun off about 1 or 2 years before I left Lucent.
Oh, and, I didn't realize they were.
Yeah, a lot of my former coworkers ended up going to Avaya, and around 2004, they became involved with a project to, when they spun off from Lucent, they didn't have a large enough organization to maintain the SGML and all the infrastructure that involved.
On the Avaya side?
Yeah, on the Avaya side. Those resources all went with Lucent.
Oh.
Yeah, including me.
right.
So, anyway, what they did is they went back into FrameMaker simply because they, you know, didn't have the resources to manage the SGML platform on their own.
Right.
And they had to actually separate from Lucent. So,
anyway,
there was a core of people there who were really regretted having to do that. And one of the outcomes of that is, you know, over the next few years, they kept thinking about how they were going to get back into something more reasonable with XML. And
that's not a story you hear every day.
When they finally put the business case together for that, my name came up as a person who might be able to come in and help them do that.
Right.
And at that point, I decided to leave Jeppesen and start TagSmiths and go ahead and come in and work with them.
Excellent. And you did a lot of really interesting things in that project.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the initial work for that project was done by ComTech with Joanne Hackos's group, the information architecture for that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and basically I came in to deal with the implementation.
Okay. So, because I know they did some interesting specializations.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, now I actually did the specializations, but Joanne and Sue Blaisdell there and a number of other people did the initial information model and whatnot, and really, you know, the information model is an abstraction. So, you know, I guess my role was to identify a couple of things in the model that really ought to be specialized.
And what kinds of things did you find?
Well, we did a specialization called resolution, which is kind of a combination. It can be alarm clearing, troubleshooting. I think error codes were the other one. Basically, anything where there's a problem resolution sort of semantic at work.
Right.
And the idea is that there's, you know, we have, well, the main lead-in element's called a condition, and then there's child tasks that are under that for how you would resolve the condition.
I see.
Basically, we end up implementing that through data maps using chunking, usually. There'll be a surrounding resolution that'll talk about what the condition is. And then for possible solutions, we'll have tasks nested in the data map. And then use chunking so that these things come out as a single HTML fragment.
Right. So how did you decide that this was a specialization requirement?
Well, we wanted to have some consistency across the products in how these things were organized. Once again, it's just the same as it was at Lucent. We wanted to get rid of arbitrary differences in structure.
There you go.
And not solve the same problem in a different way. You know, kind of like... kind of like credit card readers at gas stations, how they all do it differently.
Right.
Do the same thing.
They do. Interesting. So,
wow,
that's cool.
That was the idea behind that. The other thing we did is modeled a notion from information mapping called structure.
And what was that?
You know, basically anything with piece parts is considered a structure topic when you start describing the parts of something. And one of those things, it could be a user interface when you start describing the fields of that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So we went that way. You know, at this point, we're not quite as thrilled with that specialization as we were when we started it. At this point, we've gone to a different method where we do each field description as its own topic and then aggregate it with chunking through the data map. Now, the reason why we did that is that we found there was a lot of reuse of fields across screens at times.
Oh.
It was easier to do that through a data map than messing around with Conref.
I see. So how much reuse do you think volume is your guess?
It would just be a wild guess, but I'm thinking it's somewhere around a third. It depends on the publication, too.
Okay.
You know, Avaya has a core switching system with, you know, a lot of features, and all these features have various settings that can be enabled or disabled or quantities specified. Those things are reused across a number of different views into that administration activity. So they'll have maybe four or five different products that you can use to administer the switching system.
Cool. And is that tied to the engineering product?
Yes.
Designed in the same way?
Yeah, so there's no point really in maintaining all the setting information for each administration product when they're in common. So.
Oh, cool.
You know, and sometimes some products are optimized for administering subsets of capabilities. You know, like maybe there's a product that's optimized to help somebody running a call center manage telephone pools and that sort of thing.
Right.
Or contact centers.
I see. And where do they go for output? What are their
Well, the output is all done through a story at this point. Avaya decided to go with an Astoria hosted system. One of the things Astoria offers is a hosted integration with the Ditto Open Toolkit.
Okay. And so, what are they delivering? PDF?
Well, you get back a PDF if you select PDF, or a zip archive if you select one of the HTML outputs that contains all those files. And, you know, the output is pretty much standard Ditto Open Toolkit output.
Okay.
You know, at Avaya, we've done quite a bit of customization of the Open Toolkit to get the look and feel we want.
Right. So you're one of the few people that I've seen that considers the Open Toolkit really enterprise ready. What's your feeling on supporting it if you're not technical? I get the feeling you're very technical.
I don't know. You pretty much need to be somewhat familiar with doing XSLT if you want to do a lot of customizations to the output. Okay. So in other words, if you want to impose your own look and feel on the outputs, you need to be fairly comfortable with that. You probably need to know some basic things about cascading style sheets and also XSLFO for PDF.
Okay. All good technologies to learn anyway.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, if you're looking for something with like a graphical user interface to help you do page layout and font selection and all that, the Open Toolkit is not the way to go.
That's a questionable, that's a hard thing to do anyway with page layout when you're coming from the FO and FOSSI sort of way of looking at the world and layout.
You know, none of this stuff is impossible to learn. I mean, it's just a matter of whether you have a tenacity to learn it
and an inkling and a desire to play with it.
And the time to mess around with it. For me, it's something I like doing, which is why I went up the learning with it. But not everyone's deranged like that.
More of us than you think, but yes. So what kind of advice would you give to people who are brand new and just either starting to think about moving to dynamic publishing from traditional Word or FrameMaker environments?
Oh, yeah. I do have some advice for folks like that. And
excellent.
That is to start with a pilot project. Do something small. Don't start out with something really complicated.
That sounds good.
Check, you know, kind of test it out, see what you think about it.
Right.
And you really don't want to be doing that with the pressure of having to make live deliveries immediately and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I think that's one way in which you can, gain some experience using the platform and get to understand it a little better. Once that happens, it then becomes a little easier to forecast what sort of effort's going to be involved and what kind of payoffs you might get.
Right. So have you, where you've seen successful implementations, actually you've been lucky, all three of them have been, what kind of things do you find are common, both politically and staff-wise skills?
Well, politically, I think that it's very important to put together a powerful business case for why it is you're doing this and then get buy-in as high up the management chain as possible.
Okay.
So really, you need converts on the executive staff,
right,
who really believe in the initiative, because it does cost money to do it and it does take time.
That's true. So let's see, so far, when did Avaya start?
Oh gosh, 2004, I believe, was the initial stuff with ComTech.
Right, so they're at least 6 years in. And do you know, is Lucent still going since they started in the early 90s?
The last I heard was yes, and that was, I think I spoke with someone in 2007 from Lucent.
Wow, that's at least 10 years.
So, yeah, they were going for at least 10 years. I know at Avaya, we've actually been in production mode for 3 years now.
So production mode, does that mean you haven't had to really do a lot of work changing style sheets and getting things out the door?
No, I've stayed quite busy doing enhancements and things like that and adding capabilities.
Wow. What kinds of things are you adding?
Oh, well, for example, we ended up integrating a client-side search into the HTML output.
Nice.
And that was one thing. Also, an index in the HTML output as well.
Excellent.
It takes advantage of the index markup in the data.
Right. Very
cool. You know, the actual PDF implementation now, Avaya has been using another vendor for that. They've been using Suite Solutions, who also happen to be the maintainers of the PDF plugin for the Ditto Open Toolkit.
Oh, huh. So they, maybe the Astoria implementation, I thought the default was FOP.
I don't know. We ended up with an antenna house
interesting
engine on ours.
Okay.
I think that is their default, is antenna house.
Oh, interesting.
I might be wrong about that.
So the enhancements, I remember seeing a presentation at Content Management Strategies several years ago now. Mm-hmm. Avaya was doing sort of pioneering work with their customers to improve documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Were you part of that?
No,
or
not really.
Have any visibility into it?
I was more in the implementation end of the whole setup rather than the customer-facing side of it.
Right. It was my impression that a lot of those enhancements came out of direct conversations with their customers, like, we want this, we need to be able to do that.
I one of the things that Avaya has really been getting pressure for is to deliver more and more of their content as live HTML up on a website, so that, you know, you don't have to do these gigantic downloads whenever you want to go look at something. So
right.
That's certainly one area of activity in Avaya, is to get more of the content up on the web.
Interesting. And what does the future hold for them, other than getting the content to the web?
Well, I don't know. We're looking at a number of things for that. But, we do have a goal to try and, at least get HTML that'll match the PDFs that were generated from Ditto. FrameMaker stuff's a little more difficult to do that with, but...
I didn't know they still had stuff in Frame.
Well, yeah, a lot of stuff is remaining in Frame if it's fairly mature in the product life cycle.
That's
so
reasonable.
In other words, there's a business decision made not to convert some of the content if it looks like it may be phased out
right.
in the next few years.
And that's a good decision to make. It's the right one.
Not everything is worth converting. I mean, the conversion is not painless. You have to classify the information types, and it involves quite a bit of work it's not like when you go into Microsoft Word and tell it to save it as RTF.
The conversion
is... you're going from basically an environment that's not as semantically rich. And when you do a conversion, that becomes a problem. So in other words, in FrameMaker, the paragraph catalog really doesn't have semantics that are as deep or connote as much as the semantics in Ditto. And really, there's no programmatic way I know of actually injecting that information. It really requires someone to go through and manually clean things up.
Right, and that's long and expensive and just painful.
Yeah, well, there's some things that work. I mean, for the most part, if you find a numbered list in the content, there's probably an 80 or 90% chance that it's a task.
Right. Well, it's funny because you mentioned Rainbow. I remember Rainbow well. That's going back a ways now.
So I don't know. Anyway, yeah, that Dynatex stuff was something else. The aircraft maintenance documentation is just massive. It was unbelievable to me how big that stuff was.
It is.
Just the SGML alone on an aircraft maintenance manual is about 150 to 200 megabytes of characters, which
wow.
is just huge.
That's a room full of documentation.
Yeah, it's if you go to print it, it's a real forest killer.
Right. Wow. I mean, I remember years ago, I saw a presentation from U.S. Airlines, and she said, you know, if you stacked all our books together, it would almost reach the moon or something like that.
I can believe it. It's just insane.
It's crazy, and that stuff stays around forever.
Oh, it really does.
Do they, how much of that documentation, I want to ask, how much of it changes from year to year, and how much of it really was finished 10 years ago and hasn't seen an update?
Well, gosh, I don't know. That's really hard to say. They're constantly getting in there and adjusting this and that as they find out new things about the product. I mean, sometimes, maybe they'll find a better way of doing something. Maybe a part that they used has been replaced by a newer version. I don't know. One of the things I tried to do as a conversion programmer there was not read the content. it made me crazy when I started reading it.
Absolutely.
Because I wanted to get rid of the passive voice and say things. Just all kinds of tech writer quirks like that. It would
great.
Really rattle me.
So what's the kind of profile for someone like you who is good at doing production in an XML publishing environment? What kind of skills does somebody need?
Oh, for doing that, having a somewhat of a background in programming is helpful. Acquiring skills like learning programming with XSLT, style sheet stuff and whatnot seems to make a little more sense. Some of what I've done in the customization has involved JavaScript too, incorporating that into the HTML. For me, that skill set became so important that I actually went back to night school when I was in Lucent and got a degree in computer science.
Oh, okay. Cool.
So that's why, a guy in his 50s just graduated 5 years ago or 7 years ago.
That's great. No, I love that. That's great. At PTC User last year, we were talking, just a bunch of us, and almost no one is computer science. They all come from humanities, mostly disciplines.
My main colleague at Jeppesen has a bachelor's degree in Spanish.
Wow.
So,
there you go.
It's certainly not necessary. And, he did enough in-service training while he was there to be quite efficient at doing things. I mean, he knew Perl and XSLT and all kinds of
stuff
like that. So.
Well, I used to say if you can write structured things well, you can write structured things well.
Yeah, that's true. Very true.
So, there you go. Fabulous. Thank you so much for your time this morning. This has been great. Lots of good advice for new people getting started and a great profile of several projects that have seen real success for doing it, for taking this route. And that's great.
Okay. Well, it's been great talking to you.
All right. Thanks.
Okay.
The PubRight Podcast is a production of Single Sourcing Solutions in San Jose, California. Copyright 2009. Single Sourcing Solutions.